Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Mr. Jules Gill, now as we started talking before about Sifu, and I wanted to open the podcast on Sifu anyway, so we'll just pick up where we left off. You're raging out about being hit by one of the disciples.
Well, this is the problem, isn't it? It's like you and I, every time we meet each other for these podcast things, it's always, we have like a bit of banter beforehand before we start, and then we start recording, and I'm like, Dad, we always talk about the most insight stuff first, and it's like, it should save it for the podcast.
Yes.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the UBP, I'm Jules. He's Scott. We're talking about all your questions. But first, I've got a question for you. Sifu question mark. It's a great game. I am in love with this. I played it on live stream, Live and Let's Dice, on Wednesday, and had a fantastic time with it.
You did insanely well.
I got to the third level, and partway through the third level, and my first attempt blind, and everyone was like, "That's really good." And I'm like, "Yeah,"
because I was like, at video games. I was like, "I'll check in on Mr. Jules because I wanted to see you play Sifu." It reminds me of when we went down to play Sekiro down in London before it came out, and I got smashed. I couldn't beat. I mean, not drunk. I got actually pasted into the ground. Like, I couldn't beat that chain ogre at all. And then you were just like shrugging. Oh, what do you mean? I've got through the first boss. You were defeating Lady Butterfly. You were flying. Yeah,
I remember I got to the Corrupted Monk, and they had the PR guy. He was like standing behind me with a few of the other people. He's like, "No one's got that far. Like, do we even know what happens when people get to this part of the demo?" Like,
you and Josh have like, you're like Adonises. Like, you sort of look, I feel like you look at the game and it just completes itself at this point. Like, it's ridiculous.
I wish that was the case.
But like with Sifu, obviously the game's getting a reputation for being insanely hard. And I, like last night or the night before, whatever it was, Time's a Flat Circle, I managed to get the true ending on it, which is where you go back through the game and you beat all the bosses by depleting their stamina twice so that you can spare them. It's a whole separate thing, which I don't know if you can do first time through. The whole point of it is that you learn what happens after you beat the final boss, and then you're like, okay, I'll go back in and I'll do some of the stuff.
Unfortunately, that effect was kind of spoiled for me, because I was going through it with the mindset of just like, you know, I would play the game how it tells me it wants to be played. Yes. But looking at that, I thought to myself, because I knew that on the Wednesday morning, I was like, do I go through my first stream trying to spare them? I was like, I'm not going to do that, because that's just not how I want to play it. By the time I got to defeating the machete man in the first thing, and then Sean in the second one. Yeah, when I got to that, I was like, I want to kill these guys because they have put me through absolute hell.
That's why, like, genuinely right now, Sifu is my game of the year. I don't think it's a 5-star game, but it is, for me personally, my game of the year. Like, I think that first run through it where you're just in pure vengeance mode and you're like riding high on the power of it and you're smashing dudes into the environment, and it just feels empowering. It feels great. Yeah. Obviously, there's a lot of challenge to it, but you get through it and the game very much plays a card of like, oh, you were driven by vengeance, you were driven by bloodlust.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't escape the cyclical cycle of vengeance.
Yeah, yeah, and like go back through and really master Wude and master Kung Fu and realize what forgiveness can be or whatever. Well, it's such a good game.
Interestingly, what really I just love the movements of this game. Mm. And the whole thing of when people announced that you could obviously spare the bosses, it came as like a shock, but also there's actually hints of it that it was always an option in the very, very beginning, because when you are doing the training sequences, when it all turns red and you see all of the martial arts styles, and then it teaches you some very basic tutorials as you fight shadows of the bosses you're about to confront. When it comes to the final boss, your character goes through this very aggressive format where they do like sort of like rolling punches.
Yeah, they
do lots of very aggressive stances, and it's all punctuated by very quick, sharp movements. But then just before they face the boss, they pull a pose, they do a deep breath, they stop, pose themselves, and bow slightly like they are letting go of a ton of energy.
That's cool.
It's all of the rage had to be focused at that one point. So I was like, man, that is actually clever storytelling without saying anything.
Honestly, like the way that they, because the thing is, like obviously there was that whole story about the trophy percentage drop off on PS4, PS5. 80% of people beat the first area, beat the first boss. 27% of people then beat the second boss. So there's a massive drop off. Hence why they've patched the second boss to try and get more people through. But if you do stick with it and you get through it, the second boss is, well, other than the last one, is the hardest one in there, I would say.
Really?
But there are techniques that once you get down, you know, like the swaying stuff, you can beat all the bosses by swaying out the way of everything. It's just timing.
I've heard that the third boss is a nightmare.
Her first phase is horrible. Even like now where I've got the true ending and I know all the patterns, it still catches me out because it's so many wide sweeps.
Oh, that no, I'm really not looking forward to that. I'm not looking forward
the second phase, though, is brilliant. And just, you know, that game has so many little subtle rewards, like where you're sort of, you know, maybe you unlock the ability to catch a weapon. This just reminded me of like in the third phase, in the second phase of the third boss, she throws daggers at you that come at you really, really fast. And the first time you're just like, oh my God, can you not kill me in like two hits?
Yeah.
But then you go back having learned how to catch weapons and you can just catch them out the sky. Like, you know, you catch a kunai and throw it straight back at her again. And it's so sick. But also the thing that I think is an extra layer to it is that the story of what's really going on and like the, like who you are and who, you know, how the aging works and is it in your mind? Cause obviously your character gets killed at the very beginning and what's really been going on. If you scour all the environments first time through, you'll get a certain amount of that stuff. But second time through, you know, if you're making a point of completing it and completing the detective board that you have, which is like per area, all the information that you can find, you find a whole lore that's there about what's really been going on, who these people are, this like ancient history. I'm not going to spoil all of it, but this ancient history of what's going on in regards to time bending powers and stuff. And I was like, this is so cool. And it recontextualizes the intro and it recontextualizes who you are.
Oh,
and
really?
I'm just like, hardly anybody's going to see that stuff because of that 73% drop off. But if they do, if they stick with it, I think Sifu is incredibly rewarding. Just literally the more you play, whether you're getting better as a player or the more you explore the world, even literally realizing that you can go through the museum exhibit by exhibit and it's fundamentally an extrapolation of that character's psyche. It's so cool.
When I was going through the museum bit, I was stopping and looking at it thinking some actual time and effort's been put into these art.
They're like actual art exhibits.
I was looking at them like, oh, and they're actually like foreshadowing some of the events, because I know that the giant kunai that's swinging in the middle of the room like a pendulum that's got all of the ink dropping off of it, that goes into the final boss's like second phase, doesn't it? Where she's I was like, oh, okay, this is kind of nice foreshadowing. It's dangerous, it's huge, and it's an obstacle to overcome.
I love that thing as well, because you can just like just punch it into people. It's just so cool.
I did do that, and it's then I got clattered by it myself.
Like,
I was like getting ready
back
to like block something. I was like, come on, mate, this is the last punch, and it just went bang into the center. Like, oh my.
So how have you found
everyone,
the entire part of the podcast is where we take on as many people's questions, talking points, whatever, as possible. We did get a couple for Sifu itself though.
Cool.
So I'll throw this in, because Sifu, I mean, there's so many games now. Elden Ring will be next week, Horizon releases today. Excuse me, my throat.
It's because Pokemon, you're choking on the content.
I'm just trying to get so much stuff to talk about.
Elden Ring content.
All of the takes. But yeah, Sifu is the thing that has been dominating me. Cyberpunk, I absolutely love again. Whatever, we'll get to all those things.
Sure.
To fold one thing into the quick Sifu discussion, though, Travis Nichols says Sifu was a damn accomplishment. How can a small team with a relatively small budget make an absolute unit like Sifu, while DICE and EA with mega budgets can't make a proper sequel? Do smaller teams have better visions? Does bloated budgets create worse games? What do you think of that?
So I think that you hit the nail on the head there, because of the fact that when you get a larger budget, you have to homogenize your game to approach, make sure that you're approaching the widest market possible. It's just simple like economics. You put money in, you want that money back plus extra, and it extrapolates the more it goes up. So if I put in 10 quid, I might only want 20 quid back. But if I put in 100 million, I might want 500 million back, because that is a big risk of investment that goes in there. Now, obviously, in order to do that, it means that all of the corners have to be shaved off. It has to be the smoothest
and easiest,
the safest product possible. So that is unfortunately why big budget blockbusters do tend to sort of skirt the line of just familiarity. I mean, it's why the Far Cry franchise has just been doing the same thing over and over and over again, because it knows it can trade on what people want from that experience. Mm. And like, I'd be a hypocrite to say that I don't like people who play those games, because I play Dynasty Warriors, which is literally the same game and has been for like 20 years
like,
now.
Horizon is incredibly safe. Like, it looks gorgeous, but gameplay mechanic wise and the things you're doing, it's like the best version of the Ubisoft formula you could possibly get, meant in the best way possible. They've nailed that stuff. They've added a decent story to it, whatever, but it's very safe. You can see, Zero Dawn was the same way.
But what's really interesting is that the risk is different for an independent studio. The risk there may not be monetary in the sense of they have huge budgets that they need to make back their costs on. It may be that this is their livelihood. But because of that, that drive, that whole, like, if you do not make it here, if you do not put in your life into this project, if you do not make this the best thing, it might lead to your, like, abject failure, which, like, you know, you should always keep trying. Failure shouldn't be a reason to stop trying to do stuff, but still, it's different for smaller independent studios than it is for the bigger ones. They can absolve a loss like that.
Yep.
They won't want to, but they can. Whereas a smaller one, they put in that time, that effort, that passion, and that rewards those ingenious singular ideas that are then extrapolated out into a full game. Like Sifu, when you boil it down, is a martial arts game that has an incredibly fluid combat system. Mm-hmm. That is what it is. Mm-hmm. It's one idea done really, really well.
Yeah.
If you added that, if you put that into a bigger Batman game or something like that, people would say, oh, that is just one facet of what makes this game.
Yeah,
like, so
you would
brilliant.
Talk more about the story and stuff.
Yeah. And the more stuff you add in, the more bits and elements that you try to tack on and have unique elements to it, the more that can go wrong with the overall product. Mm-hmm. So a smaller focused designed mentality like this really does reward the smaller studio. So it's fantastic. Slow clap, big claps to them.
One thing to throw in as well is that Dave Lang, who works for Iron Galaxy, who are like a port studio, he once talked about, he's on Giant Bomb, and he was talking about how every game has a design matrix, and it's all, you know, which element affects everything else. Everything is interlocked. He was giving an example of, you know, Fallout is this insanely complex design matrix. Like, even picking up a cup affects everything else because of how that design interacts with the UI and the inventory and the way you pick it up and the animation and everything else. And he was like, once you start thinking of each game's design matrix, you see how many different points on that matrix can go wrong and how so many different things can break. Hence why the likes of Bethesda's stuff for the longest time was an absolute mess. And so if you make those projects smaller and you focus in on making sure that everything is tightly knit, then, like Jules was saying, then you can make sure it's a more proficient product overall. There are less risks being taken necessarily in the design aspect, which lets them deliver. I think as well, I have my personal theory on this. I think that as we've as society has advanced, let's say, and as social media has become more prolific, and as more data is being shared, I think that emboldens the publisher, the money cruncher, the stat cruncher side of things, which means that a lot more big business types get involved in the design and just say, why are you doing that? That's not what we should do.
Yeah.
Actually can that month's worth of stuff. The trend doesn't show they want that anymore. Everything is test audienced to death, which seems like that's what happened with Battlefield, which also happened with Anthem. And
it happened with the Avengers, because obviously Square Enix went and, like, this is taking it out of context. They blamed Crystal Dynamics for their failure, even though they were the ones that clearly insinuated
same
that the
with
game
Deus
play
X for them
and
as well.
Do exactly all of the live service model stuff that had already been accepted.
Honestly, every time any behind the scenes report comes out, like Mass Effect Andromeda or like any of the bigger teams, you can see why, if you were a largely soulless business person, let's say, you would get involved saying, well, this is going to make the most money, just do that. And then you're forever looking at the stats, you're forever looking at the test audience data, and you're forever changing that core idea of what something can be. The less money crunchy stuff at the top, the more free a design studio is, hence the likes of Sifu. And so I think that the top tier stuff is fascinating when it can actually be pulled off. Like Horizon is a gorgeous, brilliant game. I give it 4 stars. I think the story's not as good as Zero Dawn, but whatever. The vast majority of that game totally works. And the design ethos lines up with the publisher ethos, because Sony need that thing to be knocked out of the park. Mm-hmm. EA would rather kick something out and get a paycheck and fix it later, which is absolutely what the case is in Battlefield. And obviously that game has been weirdly pulled and stretched to be like a half hero shooter, half Battlefield, half Call of Duty thing.
No one's happy with it either.
Yeah, and so I think it is insane. I think that budgets are bigger than ever, but it means that the risks are bigger than ever. But then also you have people saying that things need to be safer than ever, and most of the time those elements can't combine very well, and hence the likes of Battlefield. But anyway, to get to more questions, from Richard Frutell, who says, I want to play a game, 6 major franchises, but you can only pick 2 franchises here. The others are eradicated from gaming history as well as their influence.
Right.
Which do you keep? The Legend of Zelda, Metal Gear Solid, Fallout, Monster Hunter, Final Fantasy, or Pac-Man?
Okay, Pac-Man's gone.
I'm not keeping... Yeah, Pac-Man is gone.
Yeah, just because of the fact it's so different.
This is actually quite easy, I think, for me. I would take Zelda and Metal Gear. Zelda's design ethos, the whole item-based progression, the idea of, you know, like, and secrets as well. If you're taking the original Zelda, scouring an open world, finding secrets, Metal Gear revolutionized cinematography and video games and cinematic presentation. Those two combined are the pillars of modern gaming.
Yeah, the annoying thing is that I want to keep Fallout because I have huge love for Fallout New Vegas, parts of Fallout 3, some of the shooting from Fallout 4 and all of like Fallout 1 and 2. So I want to say that, but I have to accept that Fallout 76 is part of that lineup, and I don't want to give that any love.
It's interesting if you talk about like removing the influence of these games in gaming history. Yeah. Like, if you take Fallout away, I don't think that much changes. But if you take Final Fantasy away, then you never got the JRPG brick in the West thing that happened with Final Fantasy VII, which potentially changes the whole way role-playing games played out because you don't have any of that influence anymore.
And obviously loads of nerds lose their trump card thing of at parties when they go, oh, what's the best Final Fantasy? And they try and be all like edgy and say, oh, it's Final Fantasy VI.
Have you been at my parties again?
Come on, mate. Like,
I'm just saying.
Final Fantasy VI is a great story, but it's not the best Final Fantasy game. Come on.
I'm all in on 7 or 9.
Do you know what? I heard a wild thought the other day. Somebody told me, like, no word of a lie, straight face, tell me that Final Fantasy X was the best one of the entire thing. I was like, are you actually kidding?
Who is this person?
I'm not outing them, mate, but I'm just saying that Final Fantasy X is the best one. I was like, I think maybe
if 10 was your first one, because I love 10. Like 10 was the first one on PS2. I could see the
argument. The best
for it.
One.
It's not the best one. The story's madness. My dad's a space whale. It's
pronounced Tidus, not Tidus. Oh, come off it.
Anyway, it's definitely Tidus.
Do you know what? I reckon that the developer was having a laugh when he did that interview and just said, oh, it's pronounced Tidus. It's like, are you kidding me? Like, why? He's literally from the water, tide.
That's an easy way for them to get that conversation going about Final Fantasy X again, because it all of a sudden was in the headlines again.
Yeah, it was.
Which of these two games are you?
Okay, I'm keeping Final Fantasy because I do really enjoy that. Plus, we can technically count all the spin-offs that you get from that as well. So you get like your Dirge of Cerberuses,
Tactics.
Tactics games. Telford, inviting you back to the party. Obviously, we get the Chocobo Dungeon stuff, which would be fantastic as well.
Chocobo GP's out soon as well.
I'm not holding great hopes.
I can't wait.
I'm going to play it. Don't get me wrong. I'm going to play it. But it's like when it was like, oh, fantastic speed. I'm like, oh, 30 frames per second, is it? Like, that's not speed at all. Anyway, Okay. So that's I'm keeping that one. And I think that I'm going to be keeping, what was the other options again?
You got Zelda, Metal Gear, Fallout, Monster Hunter, or Pac-Man. Pac-Man's long.
You know what? I'm going to go completely opposite to you, and I'm going to go Monster Hunter. I really love the Monster Hunter games, and like,
you know what? I would love a gaming history that was more dominated by Monster Hunter and Final Fantasy. I think
it hasn't had that much of an impact on the game overall. Like, no one is doing what Monster Hunter is doing, so it's kind of like you can see that it hasn't like perpetuated into the wider market.
There's a little bit of Monster Hunter DNA in Horizon, like going out and taking down the creatures, getting their parts. There's a bit of it in the new Pokemon in terms of like going out, doing stuff, coming back to a camp and banking everything.
See, I think that's more a Legend of Zelda, the new Pokemon game. Like it's
a little bit. It definitely is in terms of the art direction or like the overall, the sound design for sure. But in terms of gameplay loops, it reminded me a bit of Monster Hunter.
But I'm doubling down. Monster Hunter and Final Fantasy.
Either way, either of them would have massively changed gaming history, which is kind of cool. Next question from Corel Type Shaw, who says, do you think game reviews should do away with assigning scores and move to buy/skip recommendations instead? Scott seems to love Horizon sequel, but between 4-star and a 5-star review, is the difference material for gamers?
Yeah, I totally agree with this. I don't understand working in the stars percentile system. It's like, what is it? What makes a game 83% and not an 84%? Like, you know what I mean? I feel like the more you add it in, you end up in the WWE Dave Meltzer rankings thing where like your 5-star system is now a 7-star system. Once you break it, you can't do it better.
It's a 6-star match.
And if you say that something is 5 stars, that it's perfection, that there can be nothing wrong with it. Mm. And I feel that that doesn't equate right, because technically a game might be a 3.5, but your emotional investment in the game brings it to a 5-star because you love that. Like, I totally adore Deadly Premonition. Mm-hmm, but the thing is that, like, if somebody was like, oh, would you rate that? Would you recommend that? Like, 100%. Is it a good game? About 3 out of 10 game.
Yeah,
in terms of the emotional comedy that and the enjoyment that I had, 10 out of 10 games. So I'd say it's like 5 out of 5 experience, but that means nothing in the grand scheme of things.
No, as a massive nerd, one of my favorite things is review discussions, because I love all that stuff. I love all the subjective objective stuff. I think there's absolutely a way to say that a game is broken as hell, but you loved it, and there's a way to say that something is, you know, pristine and a 5-star product, but it wasn't for you. Like, I think that all those things are, that's more than valid. I think in regards to I like the star system. I mainly, potentially historically, nostalgically, I like being able to say that, oh, this is a 5-star product, or this is a 5-star game, or whatever. And I like to grade on stars. I just think that way. I'm like, oh, this is a 3-star game, a 3.5-star game. I agree with you on percentage points, though. What's the difference between 83 and 84? But I think going down the stars stuff and half stars, let's say, to push, I think that can apply quite nicely. But all that stuff about subjectivity and everything, I think all those agreements are fascinating, because for an audience, to bring it back to Type Shaw's question, that whole thing of, like, if for me with Horizon, I gave that game four stars. I think that is, to a mass audience, a 4-star game. And I still said you should go play it. It is still a recommendation. It's 4 stars. It's 8 out of 10, whatever. Yeah. But in that review, I'm giving bits and pieces of subjectivity and what didn't work for me, but I'm largely skewing towards objectivity and why it's, you know, like, comparing them as products. I think that's what you should do to a mass audience, but that's different to how me and you would talk about it. And I think all that stuff is worth.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Well,
if I could change any way that we at What Culture do our review things, it's that making sure that the review comes and is made perfectly clear that it's that one person's personalized review on it. Because whenever we say we at What Culture give this, it's like, it's not indicative of all of our views on that. But unfortunately, because of the YouTube nature, we have to be seen as a sole force.
That's a weird, like
if it was like, it's like, I give this my personal recommendation, but right. I'm not giving it a star rating. I'm just saying, I think you should go and play it.
Oh,
but
we
I don't
skew
think
different, because I go like, oh, this is a four star game. Yeah, like, I'm almost declaring that. But it's funny, because like that's one of the things that came up like over the years, is like how much a review is by default an individual's opinion. And it can only be that if you want to go wider philosophically. But at the same time, like I like that whole idea of like grading something in a review capacity and saying like, this is a 5-star product, and holding it up and being like, I'm like, look at this thing, you need to see it, it's a 5-star product. But yeah, I think it's a never-ending conversation.
The annoying thing about all of it is that I know that you look at those box arts that have all of like the 5-star rankings and like 10 out of 10 stuff on it. And my personal philosophy of, yes, I give it a personal recommendation, but please bear in mind, if you're not a fan of this series or haven't been that you might not get the most out of it, might not fit as a box quote like so well.
That's the thing. I'm always like, I always think it's just a split. It's like, if I tend to be more subjective if I'm reviewing movies on like Letterboxd or something. But like, because I think the Kung Fu Panda trilogy is a 5-star thing.
You love that Kung Fu Panda trilogy.
A good trilogy, Jules. But like, if I was actually going to give it like more of it, if I was reviewing that for What Culture, it would be more like a 4-star, 3.5-star, something like that. You'd have to be more critical of it. But yeah, I think all that stuff is fascinating. I would always encourage people to read between the lines. Don't just go to the final score, even though it's very indicative. It's obviously indicative of quality. But as is evidenced here, even between one or two reviewers, you'll get different approaches to what a review even is.
What would be quite nice to do is, if we were allowed to with the review process, is put up our sort of What Culture mandated review of like the star rating system, and like we give our sort of brief breakdown as to why it is, but then we actually do like a follow-up discussion on a podcast and stuff explaining why we came to that in much more detail. Breakdown.
We didn't ask the reviewer thing a couple of times. I forget what that was for, but which game it was. Maybe Last of Us. We did something a little while ago called Ask the Reviewer, where we sort of took different questions on and answered them that way, which, yeah, I would do way more of that stuff. As is always, the YouTube gods deign everything, because it depends what actually takes off, and then we have to answer to our Big Ben. So it depends what gets done. Next question from a Pinky, who says, anything about Cyberpunk? I'll give you a quick Cyberpunk update. It's brilliant. It was always brilliant. It's more brilliant. They've added in more stuff, scale it. It's funny because the version that you reviewed back in the day is now what we finally have on consoles.
Yeah.
So it's like everyone going like, oh, so it was brilliant. Like,
I still look back at it and I think that that's still like very shifty decisions made.
Oh, yeah.
Only can use footage that we supply. You can only review it on the PC that has the specific spec, and only if you play it on certain settings. It's like the warning signs were there, but I just didn't see them because I was so blinkered in, oh my god, I get to play Cyberpunk early. And I'm finally glad that it's only taken what, a year and a bit, and people can finally play the game. People can finally play the game that I was recommending to them before.
Yes, and it's like thankfully they've sorted and changed so much stuff, like whether it's the UI, the skills are completely different, gameplay,
rebalanced AI, a lot of those.
Combat vehicles, weapons, everything. Like, it feels so much better. And it's interesting that the behind-the-scenes report back of the Trier put together, Jason Trier, said they were always aiming for 2022, and they couldn't believe they had to release it in 2020. So this feels like what they were always aiming for. But yeah, I've always been a fan
of Cyberpunk. Imagine that, slicing two years off of your development.
I know.
Time. Imagine that. Like, just somebody coming along, like, okay, how are you doing? Oh, it's about 75% finished. Right, cool, ship it now. Done.
That's the thing. I'm fascinated. Like, that's that big business thing we talked about before, of like someone coming in going like, well, you're going to have to make it work. I mean, the more you look into the history of Cyberpunk, the more it seems like the original version of it that was more like The Witcher 3 was completely changed to throw Keanu in there and do a first-person GTA chasing thing. So yeah, I think that stuff is fascinating. I think Cyberpunk is phenomenal. Always has been to me, subjectively. But objectively now, it's a way better product. Like, it's way more polished. It's way more recommendable. People should play it. I think there's a 5-hour free trial that you can go check out.
Yeah, definitely worth it.
For the next couple of days. So yeah, definitely that. Next question from Dan. What do we think of the Resident Evil 4 remake leak suggesting they've dropped the campiness of the original for a more horror-focused tone? Have you kept up with this stuff?
I have kept up with it, but I also think it's absolute billy because of the fact that, those leaks suggested that they've taken out the sort of like the silliness and over the top nature of it. Mm. But then they look at Resident Evil Village and that was silly and over the top and had barely any horror into it. If that's them trying to do a horror game, then I fully welcome it because, mate, add more air quotes horror in because I had a right
big
laugh.
Slimy things.
It was just like, I would say that the Village and 7 are the least scary Resident Evil games that I've probably ever played. Maybe 6, actually, because of how comedically bad it was in places. But it's like, if that's them trying to do horror, but they're turning out comedy, I'm actually enjoying it more because it's like, we're going back to the Resident Evil B movie days of yore, where it's like, they're unintentionally writing terrible dialogue and creating these characters that are interacting in ridiculous ways that makes me laugh. And this is enjoyable. The thing is,
they've nailed that campy approach to horror. Like you said, Village is the zenith of it almost. Yeah. It's like, how much further can they push this? But at the same time, I wonder, I took the leaks as them trying to skew more towards Resident Evil 2's remake, where like that was quite realistically rendered and atmospheric and whatever. Like, it had its more over-the-top bosses, more towards the end, like Birkin stuff. But like,
still, I thought that's what they're going to aim for, which is weird because they're only getting like two different strands of Resident Evil as they go forward. Yeah. You've kind of got the RE2 remake and RE3 remake, and then the main series is like crazy. And like Lady Dimitrescu turns into like a giant horse wing.
Yeah, that was weird.
For the very last battle. So yeah, I think I'm a bit cautious of them changing the opening for RE4, but I guess in a way it makes the original still valuable because it's like, well, that one still stands out.
The setting of Resident Evil 4 definitely plays more towards being very horror focused in the sense of it's the creepy abandoned villages, it's the underground mines and stuff like that. They do lend well to it, and the characters such as the Regeneradors and the horrible insect like creatures that are the guards of Salvador.
Salvador's a dude. I've not played RE4 since, what is it, 2004?
What I'm trying to say is that there's tons of elements in there that could easily be just tweaked slightly and be made utterly horrific because they wouldn't need to change that much. Like the Regeneradors, which are the spiky shuffling ones.
I was going to say those big spike lads.
And the ones that go like... like if they just keep even that sound
that's me
file,
before my inhaler yeah
if they just made that sound file part of the main game, I'm in.
Yeah, I think that, like, that was the thing, that enemy, the Regenerador thing, was always held up as one of the scariest in Resident Evil anyway, so if they double down on that thing's face and re-render it and stuff, it could be cool. I'm just excited for more Resident Evil. I liked 8, but I loved 2 Remake. I was
like, 2 Remake was one of my favorite games. Like when me and you got it, we were just blasting through it, just going like, this is so good. Remember we did that stream,
it was really fun.
That was really good. Oh, I miss doing stuff like that. Well, because we did the extra cases, didn't we? And we were trying to just escape as Kendo and stuff like that.
That challenge run or whatever it was. And it's like trying to get through without getting hit. Yeah, RE2, the remake was phenomenal, to be honest. Next question from Jacob Wright. Do you think studios should hire video game consultants when adapting game series into films or TV? With the recent Uncharted film, it just feels like studios have no idea what made that game popular for a reason. Hashtag release the UPP mug.
Well, oh yeah, I know, right?
Where is it?
We need to get on our.
We've sent it to the printers. We're just waiting. Everything has to be waited on.
COO is in charge of its drop date at the moment.
The Highland Coup. He's doing Highland Coup.
As I said before, with the studios meddling with stuff and shaving all of the edges off to make things as marketable a product as possible, the Uncharted movie is exactly a case of that.
Holland.
You've taken the stuff that you know will sell. You've put in enough set pieces to get the gamers involved because they know that that set piece was in the game. It's like, oh, I know that thing. Like
the
DiCaprio meme thing.
Yeah.
And then it's just basically had the old, here is your 3-act generic action blockbuster slapped all over it. There's 3 lines of dialogue that are funny because we can put them into the trailer and we're done. Like,
it's really weird because Uncharted itself was based on Indiana Jones and those old swashbuckling movies, which now you've just made one. You've made the most generic version of that because you have to pick back apart the basics that went into it. And it's like the thing that elevated it was the interactivity in the video game side.
Yep.
And it's like, I mean, at that thing, I felt like it was doomed from the beginning. Like, obviously the casting was horrendous. Like, Mark Wahlberg as Sully is terrible. I love Tom Holland, but he's not Nathan Drake. Like, I mean, apparently in the finished film, he's better than people think, but it's still very much Tom Holland. Like,
well, I mean, in the in interviews and stuff, he's been saying that he's not super happy with his performance in it because it was the first time in any performance that he was doing poses and stuff like that to try and look video gamey. And it's like, mate, like, that's not part of why we played the video game. We didn't sit there going like, oh, Nathan Drake looks cool in this moment. We're saying we are doing cool things.
See, like, I think with the amount of like 20-year-old stuff that's coming back, there's this big nostalgia pull for like a 20-year-old ago. Like, even the Super Bowl mid performance was like, here's some stuff from 20 years ago. And I kind of wonder if you just did the Nathan Fillion version blown up into a full movie, like, everyone's like, oh, he's too old to play Drake. That's the point. Like, make him old, but make him put him through that story and do it that way. Like, do Uncharted 4's story.
Yeah.
It's really weird. I don't think they meant this to be a franchise, like sequels. They've got, probably there's a stinger at the end and stuff, but I'll be amazed if this is the Uncharted film franchise.
To go back to the question though, hiring in consultants, they probably did for this movie. They probably do for all of the movies. They probably hire in some people that have some sort of tangential knowledge of the thing. But what they do is they take that knowledge on board and they just realize that either it's going to cost way too much, it's going to take too long to film tons of scenes to set it up in the way that you're condensing a 30 to 40 hour video game story into a 2-hour movie. Mm-hmm. And then they just go, right, well, the only way that we can normally get around this is we go from generic trope A to generic trope B. Like that's the way that we do things here. We'll take your feedback on board, but we can't really change the machinations of cinema history. So yes, you can if you put money into it.
Yeah, and plus like you're dealing with different mediums. Like you're taking something that's active participation, interactivity, whatever, and you're transplanting it to a passive medium. Like you need to think about what makes those mediums work. What are their strengths? You can't just replicate the cutscenes from the game and go, well, there's the movie. It's like, well, we had that anyway. Like with that, the plain set piece is exactly the same as it is in the game.
Yeah, you literally could just go onto YouTube, type in Uncharted 2 cutscene movie and probably have a better example of a film because of the fact that you are stitching together there. Like it, I don't understand why they couldn't even just do that at the bare minimum.
Because I'm fascinated by what The Last of Us is going to feel like, because that's obviously got Neil Druckmann on board, like fundamental, you know, one of the creative directors and writers of The Last of Us. So assumedly that show will, like, I think he'll have thought of all those things. How do I transplant this across? But yeah,
it works. That sort of stuff works better for TV though, because you get like hour long episodes, you get 10 episode seasons. So you've got effectively a 10-hour movie that you can make, and you are allowed to take time and build up certain characters, show the development, show how things interact within the game world. And it makes sense because that's what we gamers are actually used to. We're actually taking time to get to learn why we like this person, being told we like somebody within the first 30 minutes, being say, you like this guy, this is what you like. It's just, it doesn't work in the same
way. No, like the ground rule is like show, don't tell. And it's like, I feel like you get it battered over your head in this regard. And we didn't talk about it actually, but what's your thoughts on the BioShock movie? It's because the Netflix.
I'm very excited, but loads of people were like, oh, it's just a singular movie. Oh, no, I'm like, mate, I don't want any Columbia. Columbia can get in the bin. Like, only because of the fact that it's just a shallow imitation of what made the original.
You won't have the budget to do like, Columbia, really.
I will have to admit that we're probably not going to see anything from BioShock 2. We can probably put that on the sideline as well. If they play it right, if they do it right, they will only have maybe one or two big daddies as the entire sort of like main focal point to it. The little sisters, you'll probably see them in fleeting glimpses. The main antagonist is always going to be Andrew Ryan, and it should just be relentless taunting, and that the moment that everyone remembers needs to be in there exactly as it is in the game. Because if they try and change it, if they try and do a bait and switch by saying, oh, actually, it wasn't this in this version of Rapture and BioShock's story, I will be very disappointed, because that's what made that game so good.
Yes.
It's just the bait and switch of like, oh, God, I actually understand why I've been playing like this the entire game.
Well, so that was my thing with this, is that that's fundamental to video games. So when they announced this as a movie, I'm like, well, the setting's great, and I like the idea of underwater cities and this like dystopia, utopia becomes a dystopia, whatever. But it is fundamentally like, it's like a fourth wall break almost. Like it is this thing that addresses player agency. I'm like, you can't do that in a passive medium. You need it to be active. Like you said, you're fundamentally playing it for that thing to land. So I don't know. I'm just like, why would you take this? And I saw this morning that they're adapting Disco Elysium and Life is Strange.
Yeah, that's gonna be odd as well.
Like, Disco's a phenomenal game, but like they're interactive. Like,
yeah,
you need, like, I don't know what you can do really.
Actually turn it into an interactive Netflix movie thing, like where you get to choose your decisions, like you do with the new thing that's just coming out.
Bandersnatch, that thing that was on.
Yeah, Bandersnatch. There's a new one that's coming out as well called Cat Burglar, I believe, where you actually get to choose like if the cat makes it through. It's like a kids' TV show, but I was like, okay, fair enough.
That's cool.
It's interesting, but that might be the only way to get a Disco Elysium TV show style up.
Netflix experimenting with this stuff. It's like, well, maybe we're going to launch games, lads. And it's like, what have you got? And they're like, oh, it's like a 2D Stranger Things game. And then it's like, now we're going to do interactive stuff.
My biggest worry with the BioShock movie is that there's actually quite a lot of material to draw on from the novel that came with it as well, because it explains Andrew Ryan's rise to success and the reason why he decided to make Rapture. And also it tells you the story of like some of the engineers who worked on it, explaining how the city actually like runs, like questions that real like fans of the series would want to know. Like, I imagine that not many people care about how the trash system works, but I enjoyed the fact that they turned that into a capitalistic issue by having one trash vendor dumping all of his trash in front of another person's store, making them go bankrupt because no one wants to go near that. Like, and no one's stopping it because it's like, hey, you can do what you want here. They need to capture that tone. But my worry is that a singular movie, if it's going to do it justice, it needs to have a before Rapture is in the state of chaos we find it in today.
Yes.
It shouldn't be Jack arrives and then it's just chaos from there on out, because it kind of needs an establishing point, a point of reference, rather than just this is a horror film underwater.
Because I wonder, they'll have to do, because it'll be, you know, it's for a new audience, assumedly. So it's, they'll have to do, here's Johnny Know-Nothing who goes in asking everything. So I wonder if they still open it on the plane. You have a character, I almost imagine him like a Tom Holland, just going, oh, what's going on? Like, it was a Big Daddy, what's this? And then, you know, they have to do it that way. Or maybe you open on Bioshock being built underwater, bits and pieces, and you cut to like 20 years later or something like that.
Yeah, maybe. There's plenty of ways to do this film justice, but it's just it's scary because Netflix, obviously, it's got a lot of money to throw around, don't get me wrong, but it hasn't produced all of the classic hits that it thinks it has, you know?
Yeah, I think that's the thing. I'm too focused on the medium artistic side of it, where I'm just like, I don't know what this brings to the world. Like, I feel like the games have already, in the Uncharted sense, we've already had an Uncharted movie in the cutscenes, we've played it. Like, I'm always curious, like, or skeptical on what can be done going forward. But yes, we got a massive response this week, as we always do, so we might carry a whole bunch of questions over to next week, but a huge thank you to everybody for sending in all their different questions and talking points and everything else. We'll keep banging our heads against Sifu. I'm going to try and get the platinum. Lord, help me, do it, mate. You've got to finish it without staying under age 25. So that means you can die like
that's
twice,
rough,
or something.
Man. Because I went back through a few of the earlier levels just to try and get my age down. So I managed to get through. What did I say to you before? It was I got through age 20.
You were
23 level 1 and level 2 I was at 29. So obviously I've missed out on the platinum. I need to go back and perfect even more now.
You've got it like in you though. I was saying to Josh, I was like, once you get the moves in you, your muscle memory reacts and you can actually block all those different moves. It was just
I just like having the permanent unlocks as well, because I'm like back and strong. It's like, throw that ball at me, I dare you.
There's a move you can get, and I forget what it's called now, but there's a move you unlock that lets you sort of like fake someone out. So they go to hit you, you just stand there and then you tap them on the back of the head.
Oh, amazing.
And
it gives you like a taunt, like a sort of thing.
Yeah, like a taunt thing, and it gives you like a time 5 multiplier immediately. Oh, so stuff like that's really cool. But yeah, massive thank you to everybody. This has been the UBP, I've been Scott Tilford, joined by Jules Gill.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll catch you next time.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.